Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what international support did Barros Basto receive in his efforts to bring crypto-Jews in Portugal back to normative Judaism? Arthur Carlos de Barros Basto was a captain in the Portuguese army and decorated for his acts of bravery and honor during World War I. After discovering his Jewish ancestry, he became an important leader, helping to establish the Jewish community in Porto and encouraging Marranos to return to normative Judaism. Ami Bar is an Israeli archaeologist and historian who's a specialist in Iberian Jewish history. This week he's speaking with us about Barros Basto, his importance to the Jewish community in Portugal, and how he fell into disgrace on trumped-up charges, causing him to become known as the Portuguese Dreyfus. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Ami. Could you first give us a little bit of background about the Jews in Portugal?
In 1492, after the expulsion from Spain, maybe tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, Jews fled to Portugal. In 1497, the King of Portugal decided not to expel them from Portugal, but instead to have them baptized forcefully, promising them there would be no inquiry or investigation into their private practices. The King of Portugal gave them a period of grace of 20 years, that is, a promise not to establish an Inquisition in the style of the Spanish Inquisition. It was much more than 20 years because the Jews of Portugal managed to put off the beginning of the Inquisition until 1536.
How did they manage to do that?
Well, by bribing church officials. Historians think that they went on bribing as the level of Vatican level, that is, the head of the church in Portugal was there, was being bribed, the different cardinals, bishops. I don't know if the king was there, he was in that also, but it went as far as Italy, as the Vatican, and there it stopped. In 1536, they established the Inquisition after all.
So what happened in 1536 to change things?
The king, the original king, was not there anymore. When the king decided to convert the Jews, it was Manuel el Afortunado, Manuel I, the one who had married the daughter of Queen Isabel and Fernando.
Of Spain.
Of Spain. The new queen, the new king, apparently didn't have the same feelings or for the Jews, or didn't see them as important as he was before. So they applied the Inquisition only in 1536.
Now, that means that the Jews had enough money to bribe the church until 1536. So were these Spanish Jews who had brought money with them, or were these Jews who had been living in Portugal before? Where did they get all this money from for all these years?
Apparently, it was mostly Portuguese Jews together with Spanish Jews. The effect of this pause was that they had enough time from 1497 until 1536 to organize their places of hiding. So they were all over Portugal. So there were, in some places, there were concentrations of the Spanish Jews, like in the northeast, in Trasos Montes, or in Beira, which is the border with Spain. It is so much so that already in our century, some investigations that were done tell us that 30% of the population were of Jewish descent, in the case of Trasos Montes and Beira.
Okay, so let's jump ahead to the 1920s. At this time, was there an open Jewish community in Portugal in the 1920s? What happened then?
Yes, they had already been allowed to come back to Portugal at the beginning of the century, the 20th century. So Jews from Eastern Europe had already established themselves in Lisbon. Jews from Morocco had also established themselves in Lisbon, and his family was there all the time. But when he was, after the First World War, by the way, he was a hero during the First World War, he was present when his grandfather died. And when his grandfather died, he asked Arturo Barros Basto to bury him as a Jew in a Jewish cemetery.
Did Arturo know that they were Jewish, or was this a surprise to him?
There were rumors. The rumors of so many Portuguese being of Jewish descent were all over the place. We don't know if he knew or not. I don't know. The thing is, history books tell us only that after his grandfather's death, or that he was told that his grandfather wanted to be buried as a Jew, that he started working at it. So the next step was for him to go to Tangiers. In Tangiers, he returned to Judaism. He converted to normative Judaism. He started studying Hebrew, studying Jewish history. He married a lady by the family name of Azincourt, which is by coincidence the same name as the chief of staff of Israel today.
Are they related?
Possibly, because they come from the same area, more or less. Possibly, very possibly. But the chief of staff doesn't talk to the press or anything about these things at all.
So he converted and returned to Judaism in Tangiers, and then he went back to Portugal, and what did he do?
He married, and he went to live in Porto. He established his base in Porto. And then he started his mission. You could call it a missionary work, to return the crypto Jews, or Marranos, as they were called, to return them to normative Judaism.
How did he find them? How did he know who they were?
I have no idea how he found them. The thing is that there were so many crypto Jews around that I suppose you'd have to ask. Like today, you can ask people, those crypto Jews who have come out in the open, you can ask them who else is of Jewish descent in that or that and that town, and they know, probably through marriages or probably because they had ceremonies together. But we don't know exactly how he knew where to go. He went from little villages to little towns on foot, on horse, visited hundreds of those little towns, brought these people out, or convinced them that it was okay to come out in the open back to the old religion.
And this was in the 1920s?
Yes, this is after the First World War. By the way, he was very well known because he was a hero of the First World War, and he had decorations. He did this job in full regalia, I mean, wearing all his uniforms and medals and all that.
So maybe some of these crypto Jews saw him and thought, well, this is an official thing. It's okay to come out because it's approved of.
It's approved. And that there is no doubt that there was fear. After living in fear for 300, 400 years, you become used to being in fear, and it's very difficult to profess Judaism openly. You are always afraid that something might happen. They are not burning Jews anymore, but something might happen to you by coming out in the open.
So was he successful at this mission?
Very successful. He reached tens of thousands of Jews in all his travels around northern Portugal and Beira and Trás-os Montes. He founded tens of synagogues in little towns. I have seen two of those synagogues, one in Covilhã and the other one in Bragança. His activities in northern Portugal attracted attention in the Portuguese press, and also the news arrived as far as London, Amsterdam and New York, which were the centers of Sephardic activity in that time. In New York there is the ancient Sephardic synagogue, then the biggest synagogue in London, the Bevis Marks, Sephardic and Portuguese and Spanish synagogue, and the great synagogue of Amsterdam. At that time, the community in Amsterdam was very big and very rich. And when they heard about his activities, they tried to reach him and to help him. In this labor, he was helped by people like Cecil Roth, Professor Cecil Roth from Cambridge, who became a writer also later on, and he writes about this in his book, The World of the Marranos. Another person who helped him from London was Lucian Wolff, himself an Ashkenazi, not a Sephardi, but he sat in the board of deputies of British Jewry. So he was at the very top of the Jewish organizations in London. And also David de Sola, who was the Sephardic rabbi in New York, came to Portugal to visit him and see what he was doing. The immediate result of this support was Lord Rothschild, the one from England, and James de Rothschild, who is the one from Paris, and the famous financier from Iraq, from the Jewish community in Iraq. The richest man in Iraq at the time was Kaduri. They helped him to build a synagogue in Porto, which is called the Synagogue of Makor Haim, and as you can see it today, it's a beautiful synagogue.
So, after all this activity, does anybody know how many Jews actually did come back to Judaism, how big the Jewish community was by that time, and how much it had grown since he began his work?
The history books tell us about 10,000 Jews were coming back, and more were, and their interest had been awakened. So maybe tens of thousands more were now waiting. He had so much success that he also founded a yeshiva in Porto with young men. But the problem starts at this time.
When are we talking about? What year?
Talking about the 30s, 35, 36. The church, we're talking now under the regime of Salazar, didn't take kindly to put it badly. They didn't take it kindly to his activities because he says he was stealing Catholics to Judaism.
I think we have to put this in a little bit of historical context also, because Salazar was one of the fascist dictators of the 30s, and and we all know what was going on in Europe at that time. So I think it was part of that same kind of movement, wasn't it?
Yes. So we don't know who influenced, who apparently it was the church who influenced Salazar to start acting against Barros Basto. The next event is that Barros Basto was brought to trial by the state of Portugal, being accused of pedophilia or pederasty, basing themselves on the fact that when you perform circumcisions, you have to suck the blood of the infant with your mouth. So he was accused of pederasty by the state and by the army.
Did he himself perform circumcisions?
Yes, he was performing, because there were no rabbis at that time. He was the only person who knew how to do it. Today, they use something that is called a pipetta of glass, so that you don't have to touch the penis of the infant. But in those times, they had to do with their mouths. The use of the pipetta, that way you prevent the passing of any disease. The case is that the church accused him of pederasty, of pedophilia. The state brought him to trial, very long trial that lasted from 35 to 37. The army kicked him out of the army, while his guilt was never proved. But anyway, the army kicked him out of the army and took away his commission.
If there was a Jewish community already in Lisbon, as you said, they must have performed circumcisions. Did they get into any trouble, or was this just a trumped-up charge to get at Barros Basto?
Trumped-up charges against Barros Basto, because the Jewish community, being normative Judaism, was not into converting or reconverting Jews back to Judaism. Barros Basto was doing exactly that. And as we know now, there might be, we don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people of Jewish ascendancy in Portugal. So he was left alone, both by the Sephardic Jews that he had been helping, both by the yeshiva people left the yeshiva, and the parents of the youngsters who were in the yeshiva took away their sons from the yeshiva. The Jews themselves, those who had already converted, those 10,000s, went down into obscurity. They went underground, complete underground. So we have a repetition of what was happening during the Inquisition, only that this time the Inquisition had adapted to the times. They were not burning people anymore, they were just frightening people with the possible punishments if they would leave Catholicism for Judaism.
So do you think that these people abandoned him because they believed any of these charges against him, or because they were afraid of the persecution, even though they trusted him anyway?
That is the case in both cases. That is true. They were afraid of what they are going to say about the Jews, because it was making a lot of noise, and the fact that Barros Basto had been kicked out of the army. Barros Basto, during the Second World War, after he was demoted from his positions, helped European Jews who had fled into Portugal to continue towards the Americas. Barros Basto himself died in 1961, alone and in poverty, and I suppose a very sad man. That's a real pity. In the 70s, after the revolution in Portugal, there was a movement to rehabilitate him, but it didn't succeed because both the army and the church and the judicial system closed ranks against this move. He was finally rehabilitated in 2012 by the Congress of the Republic, and he was given back his commission, and he was declared innocent of any charges.
Does he have any descendants, or was this just kind of a symbolic thing?
He has descendants, and his granddaughter is today one of the heads of the synagogue in Porto. Today, Barros Basto is buried in his town, Amaranto, which is north of Viseu, a little close to Viseu, to the north of it.
So he was considered the Portuguese Dreyfus. What do you think his heritage is today?
His heritage today is that tens of thousands of crypto-Jews in Portugal are conscious of their own heritage. They came, they are not afraid today, they are coming out in the open. They are not interested apparently in becoming Orthodox, but they are coming out as Jews, and they have formed associations in towns and cities all over Portugal. Thanks to the internet, they are in communication with each other today. There have been books written on this, which wouldn't be possible in the 30s, and the books keep coming out.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.